Hello and welcome back to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for. Every week, as you know, I'm joined by one of the wonderful EV Cafe team. And this week, as very often is the case, JC, I have John Curtis.
Hello, mate. It's like Hinge and Bracket or Morecambe and Unwise, as we call it.
Well, and people, you can decide for yourselves who is the unwise by the end of this podcast. But every week we're joined by innovators, pioneers, collaborators in the industry. And it's sort of an exception this time, not in the sense of not an innovator, not a pioneer, not a collaborator, but not directly in our industry, but a man with a passion has been described as a total fireball of energy on stage. What a description. And having experienced it myself at Carfest this year, I am very excited to introduce the wonderful Rick Parfitt Jr.
Yay!
Rick, welcome, Rick!
Yay.
The crowd goes wild!
Yeah!
Crowd go wild!
What an intro. But, thanks, chaps.
Well, it's deeply our pleasure to have you talking with us directly this time. So we haven't got the lovely Jason Plato in between us. You were delighting the crowds and the audiences at Carfest on the EV Cafe stage, in front of an enormous Iveco van.
And
you had a good time?
Biblical weather as well, actually. I think everyone was in absolutely the right place, because just as we went on stage, it absolutely chucked it down, didn't it? You know, so I think we had a full audience. I like to think it was because obviously Plato and I were there, but I think there might be a strong element of weather permitting that might have actually bolstered our crowd just a little.
We were the biggest umbrella in town, it has to be said.
We're usually the biggest shower in town.
But Rick, listen, it's really kind of you to come and join us on the podcast. And we will get to why EVs. But for those, if you've been living under a rock, give us a quick description of Rick the man. Where do you come from and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, that's quite a lot to tell, really. I mean, to all intents and purposes, my name's Rick Parfitt Jr. I'm in a band and I'm a now formerly mildly average race driver. Having won two British GT championships, both GT4 and GT3 titles, having raced in BTCC alongside Mr. Plato himself, and also having one of the most, well, I'd like to think one of the most successful event bands in the UK and beyond. So very lucky to be doing two of the things I'm most passionate about. Yeah, that's kind of it, really.
Well, and for those, John, come in a second, but for those of you that don't know, I mean, Rick, we stumbled across Rick when we went to Carfest this year. Carfest, an amazing event. And Rick, I know you've been doing it a lot of years, but Rick joined us in the EV Cafe village and spoke with Jason Plato. But we discovered that, Rick, you are a bit of a fan of electric cars.
Yeah. Now, you know, listen, I'm a petrol head. And oddly, you know, that in its own term is kind of archaic in a way now. You know, I'm a car head. You know, that would be the better way of describing it. And so I'm very lucky. I grew up around some cool stuff. My father was in a band called Status Quo, you know, and so he did fairly well in life. And so we had some cool cars when I was growing up. And so my love of cars was deeply inbred from day one. Inbred, that's the wrong term. Blimey. Honestly, can you tell I was gigging last night? I've had like 3 hours sleep. I'm absolutely a mess this morning. Anyway, so needless to say, I'm a big lover of all things automotive. And, you know, I raced go-karts for many, many years and was very fortunate to get into racing cars as well, thanks to the Ginetta ladder with Lawrence Tomlinson, et cetera, and went on to race with Bentley and stuff like that. However, you know, it's wonderful to see how cars evolve. I think I'm a fan of the future and the past, because I've got to the point where I've got a little stable of classic cars. I've got a Chesil 356 Speedster. You know, no one can afford the real thing, so that's about as close as I can get, and I love it to pieces. And I've recently, you know, I bought my dream poster car when I was a kid. You know, I had a 328 GTS Ferrari on my wall, and I bought that. So I've got those as my thing. But, you know, my everyday car is a Porsche Taycan. And, you know, and I test drove a lot of different EVs before I went with the Taycan, because for me, I do a lot of miles up and down the country going to gigs and for festivals and for everything else. And everyone was telling me, oh, you can't do that. You'll have range anxiety, all of the things that, you know, the common myths. The strange thing is, you know, I love the car so much in the sense of it's still very much a Porsche. The dynamics, the way it drives, the way it handles are very much Porsche. It's incredible. But I actually love the whole EV thing from a purely driving perspective, because the power is immediate. The torque curve is seamless. If you want to pass someone quickly, you can, which is a safety feature in itself. You know, having that immediate torque is a safety feature, as well as obviously being mildly entertaining. But let's go with the safety angle here.
Safety.
And, you know, and obviously, so I'm a relative early adopter on that level. And so I've obviously got the Gen 1 Taycan, the second generation, already getting way more miles and are more efficient than this one, you know, but I regularly get 250, just over 250 plus. And to be honest, that's enough time, because I also suffer from Crohn's disease. And so I have to stop every couple of hours minimum anyway, because I have to go to the loo. And so for me, it works just fine. And we did a big test in our Tesla, that was the other one I was going to buy. We did a big test in the Taycan, where we drove it down to Spain and learned to just trust the process. You know, I typed in where I wanted to go and said I wanted, you know, a percentage by the time I get down there, and it literally planned the entire route. And we trusted the process, and it was absolutely, absolutely brilliant and faultless, to be honest. I've driven over to Germany and back as well. Absolutely no problems whatsoever. And the network just keeps improving. And everyone was saying to me, oh, no, before it only takes this amount of time, and you just get your drink and you go to the loo and stuff like that. And that's the common thing that everyone says. And genuinely, that is the case. And it's just getting quicker and quicker with like 300 plus kilowatts. And, you know, the Taycan is really good because I think I've got an inverter in it, so I can accept up to 300, you know, and literally, I think the quickest was like 8 minutes I think I had like 40 miles in the tank and up to pretty much 100%, which is super quick. You know, that's not much slower than when you're filling the tank with petrol. So at the moment, I fail to see the downside at all. And I think, as like with anything, of course, there are the environmental, they say about the battery production. And I get that, I do. And I understand that fully. But it's like any emerging technology, you know, it will evolve and it will get better. And I think the way that everything is happening rapidly at the moment, I think it can only get better and better. But from a driver's perspective, how a car drives and handles, you know, I think it's awesome. So much so that my wife, you know, we got rid of her car, and we've also got a second EV. So we both drive electric, and she has the BMW iX40. And that's also an incredible, incredible machine. And the technology is unbelievable in that. I mean, I would say the technology in that is actually better than in the Porsche. But saying that, you know, they're all great. I've driven Teslas and they're, you know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, that led the way. I couldn't believe it when I first got into a Model S. I was just like, this is nuts. And how it drove itself as well, which, you know, I mean, this is the stuff that you only see in like Total Recall movies when I was a kid, you know. It's just unbelievable, you know. And and Rach's iX40 has the same thing. Obviously, you have to keep your hands on the wheel, but on a long journey, it drives and it changes lanes and does everything itself. And it's amazing, you know, when you're mildly tired coming back from a gig, and it just does the whole traffic thing really well by itself. It's amazing. So yeah, you could say I'm definitely a fan, and but I'm excited to see where it goes, basically.
I was about to ask you that, because there's a logic to what's happening on the road and using EVs that it will transition into racing. And ultimately, we will get to a point where you don't need drivers and you don't need refueling and you don't need to do all of the things that you've grown up doing. Does that fill you full of fear that we may have, you know, essentially either PlayStation type controls or ultimately AI doing the racing for you, the driver? And isn't part of the whole point of racing? It is a test not only of machine, but of man or woman.
Well, I mean, the racing side, there, someone I know very well from the racing world is already testing completely autonomous race cars that are already single seaters and they are already racing. And so that is already happening, you know, and with a view to see what happens with that. From the electric side of racing, you know, I'm very good friends with a lot of people on the Formula E grid, you know, a couple of my former teammates in karting, Sam Bird, et cetera, who I've known for a million years, is a very good friend of mine. And we used to race together at Sandown Park and in various, you know, karting events when we were younger. And so I know quite a lot of those boys. And listen, when it comes to racing, there's something visceral about noise. And that is the fundamental problem at the moment. I think that, you know, Formula E is amazing and it's great. But when they're sat on the grid and you have to have a DJ pumping music, you know, to create atmosphere, I don't know. I mean, that's the problem at the moment from a racing side. And you could also say when people criticize EVs saying that they've got no soul because of the noise of the engine and mechanicals. And of course, I get that. I'm a fan of old school engineering, you know, as I told you. So I really do love that side of it. Obviously, there's chat of hydrogen, and potentially I think that could probably be a very good alternative to batteries, to be honest. And that could solve a lot of issues on that level, because the combustion engine would keep going. It's the most, isn't it, the most, you know, abundant source on the planet. So, I mean, if they could make that affordable, I think that would be a good way. I think personally as well, I do think that the manufacturers are slightly worried from an EV perspective, because of course they don't really need servicing, you know. You use less consumables, you use less brakes, you use there's a lot less. So from a car manufacturer's point of view, they're not, their parts department is probably suffering quite heavily at the moment.
Absolutely.
Because of course EVs are far more sympathetic on that level. You know, there's far less mechanical moving parts. And so I don't know, but I'm guessing that potentially manufacturers would want to keep a combustion engine, or at least a combustion engine element. So perhaps hydrogen hybrid is potentially the way forward. I don't know. But I mean,
well,
it's a lot to discuss.
You've pushed the button there. You've pushed the button there, Rick, because we love the hydrogen debate, because there's a lot of very polarized views about that. And but I'm thought, because the noise is great. I mean, I love hearing, you know, V12 Aston or whatever it might be, you know, just kind of, I love that sort of guttural sound. It is really great. But surely, you know, the Porsche pipe sound or the Jag I-Pace, I mean, that's good enough, right? You know, can't they pipe that out?
But I mean, the love, and I think it's a generational thing, because we've grown up with stuff like this. So it's, I think it's not just about the sound, it's because of what's making it and how it's being made. So and I'm putting my petrol head on here, you know, like when you watched Formula One, now the cars don't sound anywhere near as good as when they had V10s. And the V10s, you know, I'm very fortunate to be a BRDC member, a British Racing Drivers Club member, so I've been going to Silverstone for many, many years, and holy moly, the screaming V10s when they fired up, you could hear them the other side. So it was absolutely just spine tingling and amazing. And sadly, you know, I think the cars in Formula One have got bigger and heavier and you know, they're quicker, but I don't think they sound as much. For me, I think I saw an interview with Adrian Newey, and I totally agree, which is make them smaller, lighter, and go back to a screaming engine, you know, whether that be a hybrid element, but attached to something like a V10 would be incredible. But that for me would be perfect. But I think there is another argument for sustainable fuels. Like, I think Porsche yes. have invested massively in creating synthetic fuels, which burn super cleanly, don't they? And so don't emit. And so it's an interesting world from a car fan perspective, because you just don't know where everything's going to go at the moment. But, you know, we both love our battery powered cars, and everyone always goes, is the range going to decrease? And it does a little bit, you know. It's all, you know, you never get what their manufacturers state, that's for sure. Right. And, which you just live with. And obviously when it gets colder as well, obviously the batteries definitely don't charge quite as much, but it's not as drastic as they say. So instead of getting 250, I'll probably get 230. So, you know, it's not the biggest deal from my perspective. And but I do understand the fact that I'm lucky because I can charge at home. That is infrastructure from a perspective of everyone else having, if you lived in a block of flats, or, you know, if you have to park on the street, that I get is a bit of a hassle, you know. So
yeah,
before we get into that too much, Rick, let's go back a little bit to what you were talking about right at the top of the show, which was around your journey through racing and starting in karting and GT4 and Ginetta GT4 GT3. There's an assumption in life that the higher up we go, the better it is, the more we like it, the more we enjoy it. And if you get to Formula One, that's the pinnacle. Having worked your way through the different classes, when did you have the most fun? Was it in karting, or was it as you climbed the ladder?
I would actually say the most fun I had was probably in GT4. The cars, you could throw them around. You weren't worried about the damage bill massively. You know, it was manageable. I just felt super, super confident in a GT4 car. The GT3s, I love. They're incredible. When you fired up, you know, the V8 in the twin turbo V8 in the Bentley, you know, I still to this day feel very lucky that I raced for 4 years with Bentley and Team Parker. I feel very privileged to have done that, because they don't build a GT3 car at the moment. And so I gave both version one and version two the first ever wins in Europe. So I feel very, very privileged about that. But coming back to what you said about was the fun, no, the higher up I got, the more expectation was sort of put onto me, and the more sponsorship you have to find, and looking after sponsors and doing everything, it became more of a job, you know. And and also, you know, I'm my worst and harshest critic, so if it didn't go well, I'd beat myself up quite badly about it, and that's just the way it is, I guess. But I wouldn't say the fun element is when you're doing like a track day in a race car, and you can give some people some passenger rides.
Yeah.
And you put someone who has no idea, who think they can drive or has no idea how the difference between a race car and a road car, and they think it must be fairly similar. It's really not. Like, a Citroën Saxo race car can probably beat a Porsche Turbo around Donington, because obviously it's flatter, it can corner better, it's probably on slicks, you know. There are all these elements that, you know, and obviously on the straight it'll get left, but it'll catch massively in the corners. Race cars are amazing like that. So where you can show people the difference, that was great fun. But I wouldn't say it gets any more fun the higher up you get. I would say the pressure increases, the seriousness increases, and the stress massively increases. When I was in British touring cars, I was having to learn very, very quickly, because I come from a very different way to drive. I mean, touring cars and GTs is like chalk and cheese. You might have four wheels and a steering wheel, but the whole attitude of racing and the whole strategy and the whole way you think and the mentality is completely different. I never thought about getting into someone's bumper, because you do that in a GT car, A, you're going off at 180 miles an hour, and B, you're going to end up with a 100 grand damage bill. So that wasn't really done. the first corner I entered into touring cars, my bumper came off my side. I got doored. Both my wing mirrors were hit off by other people. I was just like, what is going on here? This is nuts. And so I had to quickly change my attitude on that. But at the same time, I made a mistake. I signed to a team that I shouldn't have signed to in the second year. And the car preparation and everything was completely subpar. And I had a car that was completely, totally and utterly uncompetitive. And, you know, but all my sponsors were expecting. And so I was trying my hardest to deliver for them. And but the reality is we never had a chance. And the car was so off the pace and just wasn't being prepped well enough. And, you know, and that became very, very stressful and mentally really hard. And of course, people, of course, in the social media and everything else are going, why is Rick even doing this? He's tonking around at the back. You know, they didn't think that the year before I was over a second faster. I haven't lost that time. It was just the fact that I had a way worse car. And so, you know, it was very, very stressful. And it caused me to go, you know what, I've had enough of this now. And that's what caused me to retire, to be honest, which is not the way I wanted to finish the motorsport side of things. But it did coincide with the band really, really taking off as well. And so, to be honest, it was an easy decision because I probably wouldn't have been able to have given the time and that it deserved to race at that sort of level. So, but I'm not completely away. I will be hopefully jumping in next year and doing a few little fun things. I think I'm going to enter a C1 24-hour with a couple of mates, possibly a couple of touring car drivers as well. So we'll be doing something like that.
Really? It sounds like you're going to maintain the passionate element of it all and have the fun that you can have. So, I mean, it leads us quite nicely to that transition from, because, I mean, you've been, okay, so you're son of Rick Parfitt, so music has been...
You can't choose your parents, can you, really?
You know? Or indeed your name.
You know, if I was going to, I'd have chosen one of the Beatles, but, you know. Sorry, Dad. No.
I was going to say, you didn't do too bad. I mean, I grew up with Status Quo, so I think I was six when you were born, and I imagine that was a time where your dad was at... was at his height, you know, the early 70s, mid 70s, and remember many times, you know, Status Quo on Top of the Pops. So grew up with that. And so
Live Aid, 1985, Live Aid was like the pinnacle. Live Aid, for me, that was just the biggest moment for him.
Dad always said that no one wanted to open it. No one wanted the opening slot. And then, of course, when Quo opened it, they said, we'll
smashed
do it.
It.
You know, they did it. Everyone realized, hang on a second, that was actually a master stroke. I think that was a big thing.
But, follow that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then apparently Dad went and got absolutely hammered. And then he said he can't remember much about the going on stage at the end in the evening. But that's he's got some good stories, none of which can be repeated.
I'm sure. We won't go into those stories.
He definitely had some rock and roll stories.
Oh, yeah.
So when did it first occur to you that, that you know, music and being in a band and kind of rocking out in a way that can only be described as a fireball of energy, when did it occur to you that this could be your future career?
Well, I mean, I grew up around it. So, you know, there was always that passion. And when you... very fortunate, obviously, to be side of stage looking out onto thousands of people going nuts. I mean, that's a very intoxicating experience. And but at the same time, being the son of someone is actually, while some people think it helps you, I would think within a music industry, it kind of hindered you. And I had several false starts and, you know, and it just wasn't working out. And it unfortunately, it does put your CD in those days, you know, to the top of the pile. But it also comes with massive caveats, you know, and people have an expectation of what they want you to sound like and what you want you to be. And unfortunately, you know, you're trying desperately to try and create your own persona. But it's very difficult when you've got someone who's very well known and has such a huge standing within the music industry. And so it's quite difficult as the son of or daughter of someone who's been successful. And I think that's not just true in music. I think that's true in business or any part of life, you know, if one of your parents has been extremely successful, it can be quite difficult to actually create your own space, you know. And so I went and got a normal job, and I worked in surprise, surprise, I cycled up the road in Teddington and got a normal job at Haymarket Publishing. And I worked on Motorsport News first, then Autosport Magazine, then Autocar Magazine, and then Autosport International, and then back to Autosport Magazine. For 12 years, I worked at Haymarket Publishing. So Heseltine was my boss, yeah. And selling ads. And
no way.
Yeah. I was on the ad sales team. It was mad. And then, but I was continuing to sing in town at a night called the Kitch Lounge Riot. And that was where I really learned my trade, because you're alongside lots of other singers, whether it's from West End or famous singers, but it all come in with this house band. And it was a real, quite a cult following night, and it was always rammed at the Café de Paris, where you had 800 people right in your face. So, you know, I got invited down. I just remember being so nervous, like incredibly nervous, and shaking literally, and my head going, you don't know the lyrics to this song, you don't know the lyrics to this song. And I think I did Let Me Entertain You or something like that, whatever. And you know, and it was just, but this calm sort of came over me once I was on stage, and I went, right, I know what to do here. And did well, got everyone going, and then got invited back, and then got invited back again. And so I was becoming a weekly fixture there, and I ended up headlining because no one wanted to follow me, because I'd like end up climbing the sides and jumping into people and just being, as you described, apparently a fireball of energy. And so no one really wanted to follow. And then the head of Audi was there, PR, Audi PR UK, said, would you come and play this event we're putting on? And he said, you've got a band, haven't you? I was like, oh, yeah, I've got a band. Of course I have. You know, and, sure, easy. Of course I hadn't. I hadn't got a band at all, and I hadn't got a set list or anything. And so I stole the band from the house band from the Café de Paris. I went, lads, right, we need to put a set list together. This is what I want to do. I don't want to be like normal, like function bandy. I want to bring an absolute rock show. So I want to do big tunes. I want to segue cleverly. I want to build, take the audience on a bit of a journey. You know, every song isn't just there because it's a good song. It's got to do what it needs to do at that point in time in the set. I call it set list science. I've always been very, very particular about this. And so we ended up doing it. We absolutely smashed it. And then that came in. We ended up doing that for the next 3 years. But at the same time, another gig came in, to the point where I was approached by management, you know, and so I got management at those stages in event world. And I realized that actually corporate world was a good world to be in, because it meant I could still play with great musicians, do a great show, still be appreciated. But I didn't have to do the whole record label famous thing, you know, and which is very difficult and was getting more and more difficult. And so I thought this corporates is the way to go. And so I went headfirst into that with the aim of being the absolute best within that niche and to bring something fresh and new, because there was sort of the function bandy, wedding bandy kind of bands, and there was famous people, but this was a massive void in the middle. And I sort of saw that and I went, you know what, if I put a band together of some of the best session musicians in the UK, all who play with big name artists, all who I knew from my world, and we bring on a proper show so people feel like they're at a concert, even though they're at an event. That was my sort of remit from the start. And yeah, it went a little bit nuts. I remember handing my notice in to my boss at Autosport, and I went, I'm off to be a rock star. And they went, of course you are, mate. Of course you are. See you in 6 months. And to be fair, I thought they were probably right. I think I had like 3 gigs in the book, and I knew that I could eke the money out from those gigs. I had a big mortgage, you know. Looking back now, slightly more older and more wiser, would I have taken that step? Probably not. But you do when you're a little bit impetuous. And I thought I knew I could eke the money out for about 3 months, you know, if nothing else came in. But this is what I say to others, is that if you really want to make it work, you will work your nuts off and get on the phones, make sure your product is the best possible product it could possibly be. Make sure that the clients rebook you and, you know, and build your portfolio that way. And so that's what I did. And here we are nearly 20 years later, still one of the most sought after bands in the world for big corporate events. And oddly, now it's kind of, I've always shied away from the public side of things because I like the niche I'm in, you know, because of the whole dad thing, I've always tried to, fly a little bit under the radar. And so, we were getting such a bit of a reputation that festivals started to come knocking. And obviously our mutual friend, Mr. Chris Evans, went, "I want you to come and play this." And we did Pub in the Park and Chris saw us there and went, "I want you to come and play Carfest." And obviously for me, that was like the holy grail from my perspective, because I mean, that's both my worlds encapsulated. So I was like, there could not be a better gig for me in the entire world ever. And of course we went on and did what we did and bless everyone really embraced us. And it's gone a little bit nuts since then. You know, we've opened the Isle of Wight this year for the second time, which was incredible. As a covers band, that what we're achieving is just bonkers. Mm. We're playing some of the biggest stages at some of the biggest festivals in the world. And it's just keeping going up. Next summer is already all booked up because we've been told that we're the best party starters. And I'm happy if that's my niche, to come along, play a load of songs that everyone knows, but take them on a real journey and rock the hell out of them and get everyone ready for all the big name acts, then I'm super happy to do that. Yeah. So yeah, that's, there we are.
And Rick, I will just kind of throw my two penneth in on this, because obviously for, well, not obviously, but for the first time I saw you at this Carfest, and I'd actually caught your video with Jake Callison, who we'll come on to in a minute, but online, and I'd seen that, and I'd seen, you know, that whole video and thought, oh gosh, this is really cool. I don't really know these guys. But anyway, and then fast forward, there you were, and we had you on the, you know, on the EV Cafe Village. That was really exciting. Great to get to know you. And it was very clear, the real personality, and I could see that. So I'd said to Caroline, listen, we've got to make sure that we hot foot it down to make sure that we get to see Rick and the band. And It was about 2 minutes in, I think, where I realized, wow, what a genuine fireball of energy, whatever. But this is the point, though. You got that party started, because it was pretty, not sedate, but it was, you know, pretty sedentary up until that point. And then you just grabbed this audience by the scruff of the neck and gave them a proper shake. And by the end of it, I was like, nobody wants to follow that.
I think Chris,
because that
didn't Chris say when we came off, I think his words were, "Rick Parfitt Jr., the band no one wants to follow."
Yes, or something like that. I think he did say exactly that. And I have to say, I didn't stick around. I can't quite remember. Oh, I think I can, but I probably oughtn't to say. But I didn't really stick around for the next band, because I just thought, well, we've just seen. And so covers, but with personality. This it wasn't covers.
No.
It was RPJ band.
You know, we change a lot. So, you know, it's not the songs. We take the songs and then sort of, if I can sound mildly pretentious, we RPJ them. So there are some songs, like, you know, that we play by the weekend, like we play Blinding Lights by the Weekend, but you won't have heard that like we play it. You know, I've turned it into a real rocker chugger, ganga 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 ganga, I've been trying to go, and it turns into a real Blink 182 version of Blinding Lights, and we introduce, completely rearrange it as well. I know some say it's sacrilege, but I'm always thinking about audience response. And so, you know, I'm acutely aware of how you build energy and the call and response between a band and audience. And so, you know, we try and elicit excitement and light the fires. And so, you know, with that one, you know, we've completely changed it. You know, we put a breakdown part of it. We actually do a half-time sort of almost metal bit at the end. Da-ga, ga-ga-ga, ga-ga-ga, you know, and then, so, which is, so it doesn't sound terribly like the original, though there are obviously the normal bits. But we've done that with a lot of things. All of it is predicated to gaining, building atmosphere, building tension, building energy to big payoffs and making everyone feel like, yeah, that's what we've got to be part of. And so I guess that's what we kind of do, is which we take songs and try and make them our own in a fashion, you know. And so I guess we straddle the line a little bit, you know. And of course I have the benefit of having some of the most amazing session players in my band, or who, you know, tour the world, and they are all phenomenal. And so I'm very lucky to have, I'd say, one of the best bands in the business, and which is good, because I've always said, if you're average, surround yourselves with people who are far better than you, and you'll be fine.
I'm there. Listen, Rick, something that's always fascinated me about people like you who are massively passionate and full of energy is that you reach a peak in your set where you are absolutely buzzing. You're almost in an existential state where you just go, I'm out having an out of body experience here. You stop and you come off stage and you go back to your hotel room, or the next day you go into Tesco to buy a tin of beans, and you're Rick Parfitt Jr. again. The guy who is humble and decent and a nice guy, good with people. How the hell do you manage that massive peak and then back to normality?
I mean, the fact is, I had the benefit of watching how Dad reacted for years, right? And I think he was uncomfortable with fame. I am not famous, and I don't want to be. So I'm really happy. For me, it's a job. If I've gone out there and elicited that response, it, you know, it's wonderful and it feels amazing. But the overriding thing isn't, hey, check me out. It's actually not that. The only thing I feel like is I've done a good job. And then I come home and I just live a normal life with my wife and my dog. And I feel very fortunate to do that. Saying that, I have actually been recognized a few times this year in the most random places, and that's actually, I genuinely don't really know how to deal with it. I'd sort of just give double thumbs up, you know, to the person. I'm completely geeky. I'm a massive nerd and a big geek, and I don't quite know how to deal with it. When people make compliments and stuff after the gigs and stuff, I find it very difficult to take, you know. It's not me. I just feel happy. I've made others happy, genuinely. And I really mean that. I think I have the best job in the world. If I've come away and everyone's just gone, we've had the best time, that's me done. You know, I don't need the accolades or the applause or anything like that. It's a nice thing. And I feel very fortunate to be doing this. Bear in mind, you know, I have the best job in the world. And the other thing is, as with COVID proved, it could all go in 24 hours. Yes. It could all just stop. So for me, I'm just focused on doing the best possible job I can. Every gig, whether we're playing an awards due for a big company, or whether we're playing a private event for only a handful of people, or whether we're going out to 100,000 people at Formula One or a festival or anything like that, our show will not change. I will go in absolutely 110% gung-ho, all guns blazing. You know, that is the attitude, and I've instilled that within the band. Our show does not change. You will get whoever books us, whether it's a company or a big festival, our job is to get however many people it is front to back going nuts. And I want everyone to come away and just say, whether it's four people or 100,000, to go away happy and going, wow, that was mega, you know, that's it. And I see it as a job, you know, and it almost resets after every gig. The gig's done, it's gone. The next gig is the one I've got to focus on. How can I make it better? How can I hone my skills? How can I learn more? How can I take anything from different frontmen and go, wow, that's amazing, you know, what they did there from a performance perspective. I'm my own harshest critic, the band will tell you, but I am with them as well. You know, we look very loose and sort of like, you know, like a rock band having fun. But trust me, this band is super, super, super drilled. We are absolutely, everyone knows exactly what we're doing. And that's the way I like it. It's the same with the race team. You know, you have to have everyone on point, you know, to give yourself the best possible chance of getting the best possible result. It's exactly the same. I go onto stage in the same way that I go into qualifying. I'm really competitive. I want to win. I want to win the gig. I want to win the crowd over. And there's a little element of, I want to make it as difficult as possible to be followed as well. I will be honest. There is an element of that, you know. And I remember when we played the previous year at Carfest, it was quite fun because Rick Astley was going on after us. And we know Rick and I know a lot of his band, and Simon Merry, his drummer, has played with us as well. And, you know, of course, we did what we do. And the beautiful thing about my band is I can choose what the hell I want to play. So we could choose any song we want to do. So we've got that luxury, you know. And I remember he came on, just went, "Ladies and gentlemen, how'd you follow that? Rick's just played every song, the greatest song that's ever been written," you know. And he gave me a big hug afterwards and just went, "That was epic." And it was really lovely. Awesome. And we've had similar moments, you know, over this. Sorry if I'm talking too much over you guys.
No, you can crack on. Just bring it on.
I've had some amazing moments doing what we do. You know, I remember getting a call from Robert Plant, who's my absolute hero. Yeah, do you know what I mean? In fact, the story is, right, that he actually called, and he called via, like, the office number, and Rachel picked up, my wife, and went, "Okay, yes, no problem. Okay, perfect, fine." Put the phone down, said, "Someone from Robert Plant wants you to play with him. Is he in events?"
Brilliant.
What? I went, what? Robert? What? And then she said, "Oh, he's calling back in an hour." So I was like, fine. And I had this amazing chat with Robert, and he's saying, "I've heard you guys at the best of what you do, and I'm doing this event, and I'd love it if you could be my band, and if I'd be honored." I've still got the voicemail as well, where he said, "I'd be honored to get up and sing with you." And you're like, "Okay, fine." And that was amazing. Rick,
if I tell you that was exactly the reaction I had when Carfest said to us, "We're going to get Rick Parfitt Jr. to come along onto your stage," we're like, "On our stage? Oh no, my God.
That's ridiculous."
Seriously, it's not ridiculous. That is absolutely the truth. It was as though Robert Plant was coming.
Well,
seriously,
well,
and we weren't disappointed.
I cannot understand that sort of excitement for me. Bless you. And but we've had, like I said, we've played with Stereophonics in where we were playing in Barcelona. They were on a stage over there. We were on this stage. They were all going like this before we as we finished our set. You know, we've played all over the world. In Boston, I was joined by one of my heroes, a singer called Lou Gramm from Foreigner. Came on and did, you know, "I've been waiting for a girl like you," and all that. It was incredible. And doing, "I want to know what love is," and which was amazing. Oh God, there's been so many. We toured in the States with Belinda Carlisle and Rick Astley, which was amazing. That was really fun. We played a big gig in Boston and Atlanta. We played with Spandau Ballet in Boston, which was amazing. Wow. The boys are. It was so funny. Like, you could tell the difference between a working band and Spandau, right? So in the sense of like what we do and them being famous and rock stars, we had our dressing room next to theirs. Our dressing room, there were about 20 bottles of water, you know, and fruit selection, and all of us sitting going, right, how can we make this better? All of us analyzing the set. And then next door, they were getting hammered. Absolutely hammered. It was just the most wonderful gig. And at the end of our gigs, we went on actually after them, you know, Tony was waving and he's a good mate. And so they all made their way through the crowd and climbed up, because they'd come rather from the back of the stage, they were in front. They all climbed up on stage, and then we ended up just finishing the gig with all of us on. It was amazing. There's been so many incredible moments doing this job that I feel very lucky. Anyway, there you go.
But Rick, here's the question though, because you've said time and time again, like you're hard on yourself. You're a harshest critic. You are really working hard to deliver a great solution, a great experience, great feeling for everybody in the room. But I mean, you would be forgiven for having grown up in the environment, you know, of people thinking, people could be forgiven for thinking, you know, it's all, you know, rainbows and unicorns, right? You know, as you grew up and you grew up in this environment of your dad being, you know, effectively a global superstar as part of status quo, recognized on the street, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And you could be almost forgiven for being an arrogant little so-and-so because my dad is this, but this is not the man that we see. No. Why? Talk to us about that experience of growing up in that environment and how you got to be this person that we see.
I mean, how long have we got? The funny thing is that it's not as rosy as everyone thought. I didn't see my dad for 10 years, and let's not get into that side of it. There's a lot to tell on that side, and having a rock star as a dad has its benefits, but trust me, there are a lot of downsides as well from a family life perspective, which perhaps, you know, I didn't see him for 10 years except on the TV, you know, when mom and dad split up. So there's a lot to unpack here, and but at the same time, you're trying to create your own space. And I think there was a time when perhaps when I was living in London, I was trying to live up to this, what people expected of me to be, this rock star son, crazy party guy. And I'm probably guilty that I played up to that a little bit because I genuinely thought that's what people expected of me. Because with the Crohn's and everything else, through all the years of being very, very ill and very, very thin, you know, no one noticed me. And I just became very insecure and insular. And so this was the act, and I put this act on a lot, and it took me a lot of years to become actually quite happy with who I was and actually go, you know what, I don't need to be this, I don't need to be acting. And it affected relationships and everything else as well, because I thought people were only interested in that person and not the real person, which is a bit geeky, a bit nerdy, and unfortunately has a bit of an illness and can actually suffer quite badly. And I would sense in essence say I was quite a boring person. But then I met my wife, and Rachel is one of the most incredible people I think I've ever met in my entire life. And she made me see that there was a future in actually just being me and not having to put on a show for anyone anymore. And she believed in my talent. She's a very clever girl. She manages the band and also two of our other businesses as well. And she's an incredible person. Her work ethic is unbelievable. Everyone who knows her, she's a very, very together, solid and level person. And we've always said our relationship is like that, like her and me. She's like a nice level line and I'm like this. and that is how it works. And genuinely, that's what I think changed me as a person, was finding the right person who actually saw who I was for me as opposed to the environment and that I was placing myself in. And as soon as I met her, I removed myself from that environment and realized that my future was just about looking for all the good things in life. And I feel very fortunate. So there you go.
Fantastic. And thank you for you know, giving us a taste of that. You've touched on the fact of Crohn's a couple of times, and I know you're an
We're not talking a lot about EVs at the moment, are we?
we can come back to that. We like to understand the man behind all of this.
The battery powered car,
the steering wheel.
Yes, we'll come on to that. Forgive us, Rick.
No, it's cool. It's fine. Yeah. Carry on.
But I did think that it would be important from your perspective, because I think, you know, what we see here is somebody that is very passionate about life and living and giving people opportunities and all of that sort of stuff. But and you know, you've suffered for many years with Crohn's. I mean, how does that affect you, and what, why, how is it helping to kind of move things forward for that, you know, that charity that you support?
At the moment, I'm really lucky. I was one of the last big operations to happen in 2020, just before COVID hit. And I was in Guy's and St. Thomas's as well when the first case came into the hospital, and everyone was like panicking and stuff. I've suffered from Crohn's since I was 9 years old. I've had four major bowel resections, and what people don't realize is all through my teenage years, I was very, very ill. And so this, unfortunately, is where you're meant to form your character and become, you know, the gung-ho person. But I was very, very thin and very ill, and so I wouldn't go to parties because I would need to go to the loo, or I'd be in pain, and, you know, and that was it. At my 21st birthday, I was 5.5 stone, you know, sat in a hospital with everything ripped up, and, you know, dark thoughts start entering your head going, is this my life? You know, when everyone else is starting to get ahead and do what they want to do, and I couldn't. And it was horrible, to be honest. But, you know, then remission happens. You know, as in it was worth going through, and get the long recovery was great. And at 20, I've always said my life truly sort of began at 23, when I had the first major bowel resection, because suddenly I started to actually feel virtually normal again, and I could put on weight and not dress like an onion and not feel like I was apologizing for myself. And also girls started taking a bit of an interest, which was great, you know, and then naturally I got better and went nuts. You know, for a few years to try and make up for it. And, you know, and then obviously, yeah, that was kind of what it is. And then unfortunately it came back with a vengeance. And in 2010, I had my second major op. And, you know, that was horrible again. And then in 2020, so it's almost, I mean, 10-year cycles. And I've been lucky to avoid a bag. I was marked up to have a bag at the or a colostomy, as people know it, on my last one. And I was, you know, you struggle with the mental side of that as well. But there are a lot of very inspirational people. So I was looking up, even though I'm an ambassador for Crohn's and Colitis UK, and I'm absolutely one that wanted to push out a message of, look, you know, I've just won GT3. You know, I'm standing on stage in front of thousands of people. You can all do this, because it gets you. What people don't realize is and I'm sure this is same with a lot of other illnesses as well, is the fact that it's not just the physical disability side of it, it's also the mental thing that happens with it as well. Like I said, I still carry the scars of the insecurity and the sort of the insular person I was, because, you know, those are just character traits which are very difficult to get rid of when they've been so prevalent within your formative years. And so I've always said, you know, go out and achieve with what you do, but surround yourself with good people who understand what it is you are and who it is you are and what you're going through. And like I said, I have the most amazing wife in the world. And and that's what got me through a lot of dark times. And in my later life, managed to create, basically turn me into the person I actually have always kind of wanted to be, essentially. And so it is one of those things that I've had to live with. When I was racing, there were moments when I was literally on the floor crying, you know, in the motorhome, and I'd actually take painkillers, as many painkillers as I could, and then put my helmet on and get in the car and drive. At Silverstone, the picture which is behind me up there, I remember I was very, very unwell that weekend. I was very weak, but Stuart Parker from Team Parker Racing, who's an absolute legend in racing circles, still the best team manager I ever drove for. He's incredible. He was so sympathetic. He said, all you need to do is do motorhome and car. I'll keep everyone else away from you. Just focus on these two things. You know, we'll be with you. You can come in. So we devised a strategy that because they knew how unwell I was, where we would run short in the first stint. We'd run the car light. We'd qualified second. I was always quick around Silverstone, but, you know, I didn't have a lot of energy that day. So we'd run a shorter stint and offset the stint. So normally the rule is you fuel for as long as you can, because it's a 3-hour race, you know, but we did for 20 minutes. And so gives me a little bit of a good chance, because the guy on pole was actually a silver graded driver. So, you know, a pro, to a certain extent. And I remember going around the warm-up lap, and you have to put so much energy into the tyres. They're big tyres on GT cars to get them up to temperature. And it's a long lap around Silverstone. And I was literally nearly puking up in my helmet. I felt so bad. And I knew as we came round, it's a rolling start, as we came round to the start line, I went, I haven't got the energy to be in a fight for half an hour with this guy. I haven't got the energy. I need to get away. I need to get, and I was so ready. I felt so, boom. And I got past him on turn one and just went like they're clappers. And probably one of the best stints I've ever driven in my life, you know, came in and I put 9 seconds on him, you know, which was massive. And of course, Seb, my teammate, a pro, went out on the second half, offset against the other bronze graded drivers, pulled all the time back. And so by the time I was against the pros, half the pros, I was still matching, just matching the pros. I was losing very little time to get these consummate professionals. And we won by over a minute. And still to this day, no one's ever won Silverstone 500 by that margin. And it was down to strategy and playing to the strengths and weaknesses, in my case, of maximizing the potential of both us and the car and everything else. And that was genius by Stuart and the guys, you know, and Rich, who was our engineer. And I remember Mark Lemmer from Barwell, the Lamborghini team, came over, just shook my hand and went, that was genius, you know. And since then, you've seen it as a strategy. Other people are adopting it now. There are people going and fueling short. So I've gone, yeah, we did that first, man. You know,
trailblazer.
Yeah, so it was quite cool. It was quite cool, yeah.
Fantastic. Now, you called it out, Rick, and you said, we've not talked much about EVs. And as an EV ambassador almost, you must have petrolhead friends who come to you and say, why do you drive that thing?
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
Well, I literally had one the other day. One of my oldest friends used to work on Autosport with me. He was actually my ad manager, right? He's honestly one of my oldest friends. We're both absolute car nuts. And so he was just like, I don't want to like this. I'm not going to like it. You know, it's just the way it is. And he came up because he was buying a Lotus Esprit. Dear, oh dear, that didn't go well. Bought it one week, got it 30 miles away. It broke down, trailed back to the guy. Guy said it's fixed. Came up all the way from Surrey to, I live in Nottingham. We went to Doncaster, picked it up again. We got it within 2 miles of my house. It broke down again. And anyway, so it got trailed back. He said, that's it. And so I said, well, I'm driving down south to gig. So why don't we just stay at mine and we'll drive down together, you know? And so that's what he did. And I said, you drive, because he always complains about getting car sick. So I was like, fine, you drive. And we drove the Taycan all the way back. And he just went, oh my God. He went, it's phenomenal. He said I was exactly. and he just went, and also the way it rides and on long journeys, he was just going, this is just, you could just cross continents with this. And I was like, I know, it's mega. And, you know, and so he got it and he went, okay, I get it. That's it. And now he's buying an EV now, you know, he's buying an electric car. And,
Bums on seats.
Yeah. And this is the thing. It can only get better. So like I said, but it was interesting, and he was one of the most toughest people to convince, you know, because he has lots of cars. He's got an E-Type, you know, oh God, he changes his cars like the wind, you know. We're both like as bad as each other. It's atrocious. And, but he was completely sold by the end of it. He understood it. And all the comments, I think, mostly come from people who haven't lived with one. I am a petrol head. I have an interesting life where I need to rely on the car to get me to places, and, you know, and I can be gigging in the middle of nowhere as well, you know. So sometimes if you're like, I don't know, gigging in Brecon Beacons or somewhere in, like, you know, rolling Welsh hills, yeah, you've got to be a little bit more savvy about where it is. But the weird thing is, you go, okay, I'm going to stop there and fill it up for, you know, 12 minutes and have 100%, then I'll get there. And then the next day I can get back to here and just do another 12 minutes where I get a cup of tea and get home. So there is a little bit of planning sometimes, But at the moment, I've only ever had range anxiety once. And that was only because one of the place that I went to, they weren't working. And so that's the only other thing I would say at the moment is on occasions, so, you know, there needs to be a bit more consistency on some of the chargers working, but that's just getting better and better and better now, you know. But apart from that, like I said, Germany and back, no problem. Spain to the bottom of Spain and back, no problem. It was amazing.
And we, given that, that, you know, electric technology is moving on to the degree it is, you know, with your passion, your mindset, your love of this technology, what do you think is needed in the automotive industry to really kind of move this forward? Because, you know, you could argue that some people are that it's stalling a bit, you know, but you seem to bring something, you know, different and, you know, communicate in a way. Do you think the industry is missing something? Are we, should we be doing something different to get the message out there?
I just think it's just, I think it's, I think it's, we're in limbo at the moment. I think no one quite knows which is the quintessential way forward. No one wants to fully commit to batteries because, of course, of the environmental impact of the batteries. I get that. But it's like anything. If they fully committed, I'm sure that there are some extremely clever people in the world who would come up with the technology to make them recyclable and made out of, you know, things that maybe can conduct better than having to dig up the earth to actually make them. You know, I have no doubt that it must be possible that the human being is capable of amazing things. And also the fact that everyone says about the battery, you know, if you could get a, and I feel pretty certain it won't be long now before batteries are doing 450, 500 miles, you know, and I think some already are, to be honest, you know, that's amazing, right? You know, if you think about the lack of energy that you'd actually be using in total consumption is great, you know, but the benefits of the drivability and everything else, if you can keep all of those factors together, plus the fact that if, you know, after 8 years, because we all worry that, you know, 8 years, the batteries won't be worth, and then the cars scrap, you know, there's got to be a technology, which I'm hoping that by the time my car gets to 8 years old, there'll be aftermarket people who go, you pop in, they pop the engine out and they put pop the, you know, the battery out and pop a new one in. I hope there'll be even aftermarket ones, you know, and it'll be better and with more denser cells, which will give me more range and whatever else, you know. So I think that the technology needs to just move on and, you know, dispel some of those myths, or, and if they aren't myths, then actually provide the solutions for it. It's as simple as that. And I'm sure that, you know, if we don't do it, you know, listen, the Chinese obviously are leading the way. You know, you see some of their efforts with regards to the electric car market, and you've got to say it's amazing. You know, some of the BYD and what was that, the thing I was next to at CarFest, the Yangwang. I mean that would be a stumbling block for me. What do you drive? Well, I drive a Yangwang.
Yangwang.
That would be a stumbling block for me. But as a car and as a thing.
Localized name.
Yeah. As a car and as a thing, holy moly, it was amazing. Yeah. You know, and so I just think there needs to be, you know, solutions to make the batteries greener and sustainable, but longer range. And also swappable, you know, and also the point where perhaps, I mean, I'd love it to be like an iPhone, where if you drive over a certain pad, you know, you have an app and you switch it and it charges like that, or something comes down from the car and touches it and charges the battery. Yeah. And then when you switch it on, it goes up or something like that. I mean, that would be amazing. I mean, obviously infrastructure would be incredible to be able to do that, but maybe they could be pads as opposed to layering under the thing. There could be universal pads put down, and that would be my world. I think that would solve all the problems of parking on the street as well. If there was this layer of stuff where your car just naturally went on and you could just press it and it would do it, you know, it would be amazing. So I think, from someone who's completely untechnical, you know, there have to be solutions, don't there? You know, I mean,
exactly.
So,
and Rick, I'm with you. I'm not particularly technical, but if I can think it, somebody somewhere can probably do it. And the good news is, so new chemistries are already available, so that remove nickel, manganese, cobalt, you know, all of those are out of batteries now, particularly BYD. We know that there's these pads, Nottingham City Council, actually, which is your home. They have a taxi rank,
induction
which has the charging points underneath the town. Absolutely. It's in the town.
I need to go and see that.
I don't know exactly where, but there's a taxi rank.
We are one of the first cities to have an all EV lane, which is really cool in Colwick. And trust me, at rush hour, there is no amount of smugness that can quite describe. I'm going down here now. Yeah, see ya. I feel bad for all of a few seconds. But
Nottingham is actually a class leading council as well. So there's a guy called Matt Ralph in the council there. So all those batteries that we've talked about, they are in a big container. They store the energy that they create from solar, put it into the containerized batteries, and then power the refuse collection vehicles that collect possibly even your rubbish, Rick.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfect, right? You know, there are solutions and which are much cuter. And, you know, like you say, solar pad. My guitarist, a guy called Joe Webb, he's currently touring the States with some band called ELO. Apparently they're quite good. Joking. Absolute Jeff Lynne, total hero. We won't go there. And although he's nicked two members of my band, but let's not go there. Joe and Shannon. But Joe has, after driving mine, he's now got an EV as well. And he's got an Ioniq 5. But he's also installed solar panels. And so he's figured that the mad thing is that he's actually, with what he's storing and using for the house and the extra stuff, he's actually charging his car for free. So he's running a car essentially for free, which is amazing. So, and that's just a normal household, you know? So you've got to say, you know, there are cuter solutions out there. It can be done.
Yeah.
It can.
And do you know what? That's the perfect note on which to say thank you. Rick, we've taken you all over the place, and I totally appreciate your willingness to come with us, because it's so important to hear about the people that are EV fans, and let's call you a normal person in terms of the EV
immensely
world. You've just gone
boring
on a journey. I'm going to disagree with you, humbly, of course, but I'm going to disagree. But this has been a real pleasure for us, and I know that, you know, those people that are listening will get a really very real world view of how electric vehicles fit into the, you know, almost any context, from a Ioniq 5 to the Taycan to the iX40, all of those things. And also just that simple understanding that things will change. We're going to look at the world with innovation in mind, you know, wireless charging. Who would know that it was actually available in your home?
Can I just say one thing, though?
Go on.
Depreciation of a Taycan is utterly ridiculous.
Buy a used one.
Buy a used one. What a bargain now. Oh, my God. You know, don't buy a new one.
No. Well,
Porsche, I love you and everything, but my God, it hurts.
You just got to run it for longer, Rick. That's all. You just got to run it until it's a classic.
Into the ground, trust me. That let me tell you. Anyway, there you go.
But we could start a whole new podcast on the whole depreciation, used values, and all of those kinds of things. They are challenging, but
opportunities, but though. That's the thing.
Opportunities.
There are cars that you can get into. I mean, even if you look at it, we found that. Without finishing, it's like you look at the early Model S's, Teslas. Some of those have got free charging for life.
Yes,
and it's transferable, and the batteries aren't degrading as, you know, on a charge level as much as everyone was expecting. So you can get in for very little money into a Model S and yet charge it for free still. The secondhand market is now establishing itself. So oddly, now is a great time before the market realizes where it's at. You can get secondhand bargains. I think all that have come off the company car lease schemes or all those sort of things, you can grab an absolute bargain. And I genuinely think, you know, now is a good time to get into EVs because the infrastructure is mega, and especially when you hit to Europe as well, it's just mind blowing. In fact, I'd say a lot better than here. Sorry to say, you know, and so get into an EV.
Well, Rick, so we had a session on used electric vehicles this year at the EV Cafe on the stand. Maybe you'd like to join us for a session around discussing the value of used. You can give your own example.
Well,
mine's worth nothing. Anybody want to buy it?
I can neither confirm nor deny the fact that I might be back at Carfest next year. Oh. Yeah, you know, we are in discussions. But if I'm there, I'd love to come and have a chat with you all.
Well, we're in a similar place, Rick. We can neither confirm nor deny, but we'll see you there.
Let's hope. Rick Parfitt Jr., an absolute delight and a pleasure. John, it's been a thrilling ride, hasn't it?
One of the things that I love about Rick is that when people talk about communicating messages, they say, be real, be authentic. And you, my friend, are every bit as lovely on a call, face to face, when you're on stage, when you're meeting. And I saw a number of your fans come up to you and want photographs and autographs. You take time with people. You are an absolute gentleman, and I can't thank you enough.
Oh, God. Thank you. That's very sweet. I can't take it, obviously, but that's very obviously. Sweet. Very right.
That's the sport that we enjoy.
Thanks, guys.
But Rick, listen, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
And everybody, please connect with Rick. I'm sure you're on Instagram, I know.
Come see my band.
Come Yay! See his band. Book his band, even better than that.
Book the
I mean,
band.
If you're thinking corporate event, if you're thinking, I mean, these guys Private are the people.
We're not fussy. We'll come. If you book us,
absolutely.
We can come.
Birthday parties, you know. I think there's probably an age limit. There's an age limit, right?
There is. Anyway, cool.
Been fantastic. Thank you. And do check out all the other podcasts that we have on the EV Cafe Takeaway on evcafe.org. And follow us on LinkedIn. Check in with Rick on whatever medium you can find him. Rick Parfitt Jr., amazing character. And we can only just advocate that wherever you get the opportunity, check this guy out. Absolutely. Amazing. Over and out, everybody. Have a great day.